Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
Good evening. First, thanks to Jeremy and the church for inviting me to come here and speak with you. I think that's a really nice opportunity for me to get to do this. I was interested to hear Melanie say that we decided to stray from the topic of the problem of evil, and we decided to do that by getting a lawyer up on the stage. So I'll let you draw the conclusions you want. So, separation of church and state. What provision of the United States Constitution expressly states that there must be a separation of church and state? Well, there's none. So why do we speak of separation of church and state? There are a number of reasons that we may do that. First, separation of church and state, and I will just abbreviate it to separation for most of the talk tonight, it's understood by many to be a principle or a value that underlies a specific provision of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. In this sense, separation is a constitutional norm. This is the idea of separation that I'm going to spend most of my time on in my talk, although of course you're free to ask whatever related question you want to do at the end of the discussion. Now, secondly, separation is also understood by many to be a political principle or value, quite apart from whether it is compelled by the United States Constitution. So in this sense, separation is just a political ideal that should govern the political ethic. The ethic that government officials use, and maybe even the ethic that private citizens use as they vote and interact in public life. A third idea is that separation is a theological or a biblical concept. After all, the Lord Jesus recognized at least some distinction between the purview of government and the overarching rule of God. He told the Pharisees and the Herodians, for example, that when he was presented with a coin and asked the question of whether tribute should be paid to Caesar, render the things that are Caesar and to God the things that are God's, right? And when he was before Pontius Pilate, he assured Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world." So there is some distinction within the Bible's teaching on the unique purpose of the church, the purpose of the kingdom of God, and a more limited scope or purpose that God has for government. So in this sense, we can think of separation as a theological idea too. I should also say that there are different understandings of what separation means in these three different senses or concepts of the term. So what I'm saying is that we might think that separation means one thing in one context, that it means something else in another context, and so forth. And I'd also like to say that even if we agree that separation in some sense should be a valid and a guiding constitutional norm, it doesn't necessarily follow that it should have the same scope in other senses of the term. For example, we might think that one particular scope is appropriate in terms of what the Constitution requires of separation, but we might think that a broader scope is still advisable as a matter of a political ideal. And we might also think that an even broader separation is appropriate, or a less broad for theological reasons. So we need to keep those concepts and recognize that they are distinct, and that for purposes of the discussion tonight, I'm going to be focusing on the constitutional norm aspect of separation of church and state. Now, we could take the entire time just trying to categorize different types of separation. Now, when I say different types of separation, I'm not even saying that, you know, we could spend the whole time discussing scope. That's true, we could. We could take the whole time discussing scope. But we could also take the whole time just trying to figure out what types of separation that we think are appropriate. And to give you some sense for the different types of separation that we might want to think about, I'm going to lay several out on the table for you. Now, some of these types of separation that I'm going to mention have appeared in the Supreme Court jurisprudence on separation of church and state as an animating principle of the First Amendment. But what I'm going to do right now is not to lay out what the Supreme Court has said, or these are like the only types we need to think about, okay? We need to have some kind of framework for approaching the issue, theoretically. And so I'm gonna lay out, just theoretically, some different types of separation that what we might think of are worthy of analyzing. So one type, probably the most obvious type, is what I would call institutional separation. Here we recognize a distinction between the functions, personnel, and internal administrative operations of church and state. So, for example, the government doesn't get to appoint church officers. The government doesn't get to tell us who our pastor is, Jeremy. And the church as an institution doesn't get to appoint government officials to their public offices. So, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention doesn't get to choose the president, for example. Also, the government doesn't get to tell churches what to preach, what to adopt as their creed. And the church doesn't get to exercise official government functions. Like, the church doesn't get to tax. The church doesn't get to approve public licenses for various industries, that kind of thing, an institutional separation. Now, another kind of separation that we might think worthy of recognizing would simply be doctrinal separation. Here, government cannot suppress or support beliefs or professions of belief uniquely associated with one or more religions, or suppress beliefs because they conflict with some religious belief. So, for example, government cannot penalize someone for believing that Jesus Christ is the Lord of all creation, nor can the government compel profession of such a belief, doctrinal separation. We might also think of liturgical separation. Here, the idea would be that government is prevented from adopting or prohibiting the liturgy of religion. So, government cannot sponsor prayers. Government cannot sponsor other forms of worship or embrace a particular canonical text, liturgical separation. Related, but still conceptually broader, we might think of religious practice separation. So here we would be thinking of something like this. Government cannot require conformity or forbid conformity to a behavior that is uniquely associated with a religious belief. So, for example, the government cannot enact laws against blasphemy or laws that require people to tithe. Now, we might also want to think about symbolic separation. So here the idea would be that government cannot adopt the symbols of a religion or show preference for certain symbols of one or more religions. An example might be the use of public nativity scenes, displays of crosses or monuments with the Ten Commandments. We actually see some of this kind of separation in the Supreme Court jurisprudence quite a bit. Now, we might think of something called fiscal separation, not physical, fiscal, F-I-S-C-A-L, fiscal separation. So, under this concept, government cannot transfer public funds to support religion or religious entities, or perhaps just the religious activities of religious entities. I would also put discussions about taxation and tax exemption in this category, this idea that there should be some kind of fiscal separation. Now, the most radical concept of separation, that's something of a hot topic today, is something I would call moral separation. Now, I will tell you right now, we're supported by existing constitutional precedent. The idea would be that government must thereof. So the first part of the First Amendment clauses that we're talking about, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's the Establishment Clause. Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion is the Free Exercise Clause. Collectively, they are referred to as the religion clauses, and they are not self-defining. The Constitution doesn't come with a list of answers to frequently asked questions. Courts look at all kinds of sources to try to faithfully interpret the Constitution. So grammar, you know, syntax and structure, and original lexical or dictionary meanings used by the public at the time of the founding or the ratification of the Constitution, historical occasion, all kinds of tools that courts use to try to figure out the meaning of the constitutional text. And for purposes of our discussion tonight, remember the text that is critical is the religion clauses of the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, and the Free Exercise Clause. what do they mean? Well, in addition to those other sources that courts draw upon that I just mentioned, some courts will look at what they perceive to be the underlying principles, general ideals or values behind a particular constitutional provision, in this case, the religion clauses. So, for example, the courts might try to figure out what is the meaning of the Establishment Clause by trying to figure out, well, what's the basic ideal behind it? What's the basic value underlying it? A court that sees the separation norm as being the one of the basic values underlying the Establishment Clause then would try to figure out, well, okay, what should the separation norm then say in to us in interpreting the religion clauses? Now, there are three major norms, and you could cite others, but there are three, I would say, major norms that have thought to undergird the religion clauses. One is neutrality or equality, either among religions or between religion and non-religion. Neutrality, the neutrality norm. Another clause itself, Congress shall make no law, prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So naturally, religious liberty, I mean, it's in the very terms of the free exercise clause, but the term, the norm of religious liberty is also thought to underlie the Establishment Clause. And then a third major norm is the separation norm, the separation of church and state. And I will focus most of my discussion tonight on how the court has interpreted the religion clauses of the First Amendment in view of these underlying norms. Now, I will tell you that right now, I would say the most prominent norm that has tended to guide the court is the neutrality norm. And even when they cite one of the other norms, they tend to look at it as related to neutrality. So it's very important. The Supreme Court has used a few different tests in understanding what the religion clauses mean. We will start with the Establishment Clause. I will briefly tell you the major tests or factors the court uses in interpreting the Establishment Clause. Then I will tell you what the current jurisprudence of the Free Exercise Clause is. So a few different tests have been employed to try to figure out whether the Establishment Clause has been violated. For over 30 years, beginning in the early 70s, the Supreme Court used the so-called Lemon Test, a test announced in a case called Lemon v. Kurtzman. Three prongs to that of God and religion generally in the minds of the people, in the history of the state and the nation, and concluded with that kind of historical background and the passivity of just having the text on a monument among many other monuments, there was not a violation of the Establishment Clause. Now change the facts a little bit, and you get a completely different result. In fact, that happened that same year in a case called McCreary County, where you had Kentucky courthouses featuring the Ten Commandments more prominently than any other kind of document. I mean, at first, I think it was almost exclusively the Ten Commandments that were being featured, and there were complaints, and so, you know, they threw in a few more documents that referenced the role of religion in the history of the country, and then I think there was a third iteration when they threw in even more documents. But in this case, because of the prominence of the Ten Commandments in the displays, the court struck the displays down, the actions of the government down. And far from ignoring Lemon, there, Lemon commanded the majority of the justices. Now, another test that the Supreme Court uses has been the endorsement test. And it's a kind of gloss on the Lemon test about how a neutral observer would perceive the government action in question. Would it perceive the government to be in having the purpose of endorsing or disfavoring religion? And then would the effect of Lemon be to endorse or disapprove of religion? And then finally, the court sometimes looks specifically to coercion itself. Is the practice involved coercive at some level to someone in their exercise of religion? For the Free Exercise Clause, the court kind of upended it's historical jurisprudence in a case called Employment Division v. Smith in the early 90s, and it involved the use of peyote by some practitioners of a Native American religion. And here, for the Free Exercise Clause, what we basically have is a Supreme Court opinion saying that as long as the law is neutral and of general applicability, there's not going to be a violation of the Free Exercise Clause as long as there's a rational basis for the government action. Now, if you have, so this is true even if it burdens a religious practice. If it's a neutral law, generally applicable, like, you know, prohibition against drug use, including peyote. Now, if it's the seeming scope of it, I want to cite Zorak v. Clausen. This was a case where the court upheld the constitutionality of a release time program in New York City. Now, you said, I thought release time programs didn't work. Different facts. Here, the facts are that the school said, okay, you can leave the school, okay, the tax-supported facility, you can leave it for a limited amount of time and go off campus and receive some religious instruction during the school hours. Court held no violation of the Establishment Clause. Now, it started by saying, you know, there can be no doubt that we embrace separation of church and state, and that as far as it applies, it's absolute. But then it said this: the First Amendment, however, does not say that in every and all respects there shall be a separation of church and state. Rather, it studiously defines the manner, the specific ways in which there shall be no concert or union or dependency one on the other. That's the common sense of the matter. Otherwise, the state and religion would be aliens to each other, hostile, suspicious, and even unfriendly. Note carefully what this court is saying. That's not what separation of church and state means. It doesn't imply hostility. Churches could not be required to pay even property taxes. Municipalities would not be permitted to render police or fire protection to religious groups. I saw an officer in here earlier. You see one on Sunday morning. I'm very thankful for those people, especially in this day and age. Prayers in our legislative halls, the appeals to the Almighty in the messages of the chief executive, the proclamations making Thanksgiving Day a holiday, so help me God in our courtroom oaths, these and all other references to the Almighty that run through our laws, our public rituals, our ceremonies would be flouting the First Amendment. A fastidious atheist or agnostic could even object to the supplication with which the court opens each session, God save the United States and this honorable court. So what the Zurich court is telling us is that, yes, separation in church of state. No, hostility between church and state. You have to explain the meaning. You have to explore what the concept really means. You can't take it, the court says, you know, in what some would perceive to be its logical extremes. Now, the court has also invoked other norms. As I said, neutrality is the most prominent. Also, at times, you will see religious liberty as well. What I want to do is spend the remaining just few minutes, because I don't want to take up all the time before Q&A. I want to explain to you a particular application of this idea that we do not have an absolute separation of church and state in this country. And for this principle, I'm going to speak to a case called McDaniel v. Patey. In this case, the court examined a clergy disqualification statute. So here, I like this case also because it involved a Baptist. In Patey, an ordained Baptist minister had been elected as a delegate to a state constitutional convention, but he was later disqualified from serving as such under a Tennessee law barring clergy from serving as delegates or as a legislator. And the Patey court found that the state law violated the minister's right to free exercise of religion. It was a plurality opinion, and Chief Justice Berger, writing for the plurality, traced the history of the disqualification of ministers from legislative office from England all the way through colonies in the states, and noted that although they were once thought necessary on anti-establishment grounds, that now this burdens the free exercise of religion. The court cited James Madison's view that a clergy disqualification law punishes a religious profession with the privation of a civil right. So note what that means, that the free exercise of religion is considered to be prohibited, not simply when government imposes a criminal penalty for the exercise of religion, but when the government deprives the adherent of a civic right serving in public office. And then Patey rejected the position that Tennessee could justify its official bias against public service on service by clergy on anti-establishment grounds. It said this: given the Americans' experiment, we have a long history to observe, the American experience provides no persuasive support for the fear that clergymen in public office will be less careful of anti-establishment interests or less faithful to their oaths of civic office than their unordained counterparts. And interestingly, in a footnote, the Patey Court elaborated on this conclusion by observing that in Virginia, the struggle for separation of church and state, a struggle that influenced other states and even the federal government in the First Amendment, saw the participation of many clergymen vigorously opposed to an established church. Now, did you get that? That the court recognized that the voice of clergy was in favor of some version of separation of church and state, anti-establishmentism. So I will end on this ironic observation of the Patey Court. The political effort for some version of separation of church and state, disestablishment of religion, it was led by pastors, in part, acting on political religious motivations. How strange it would be to conceive of separation of church and state as prohibiting the very religious voices in politics that led to one form of its embodiment, the religion clauses of the First Amendment.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information on Veritas, visit www.veritaswbc.com.